Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to another episode of Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. My name's Joe Haddo, and I'll be the ringmaster for the upcoming War of the Words, which will ensue between two debut writers a little later on. Before we meet our guests, a little bit of admin. Firstly, welcome to any new listeners who are joining us. We have virtual open arms here and are so glad that you stopped by to listen. We hope that you will explore the other series of Book Off. And to all our regular listeners, much literary love to you all, and thanks for your continued support of the podcast. So then, to business. And today, as ever, I'm joined by two brilliant authors, two debut authors, who are going to be telling us about their new books, their writing, and what they've enjoyed reading recently. My first guest is a Chinese takeaway owner from West Wales who recently won Richard and Judy's Search for a Bestseller competition and is now a published author, a dream that she has had since she was a young girl. Here to tell us about Happy Families is Julie Marr. Hello, Julie.
Hello, Joe.
Welcome to Book Off. It's lovely to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And the listeners can't see, but I noticed that you've got the perfect setting there on camera of the Chinese takeaway in the background. Very on brand.
Yes, the Chinese takeaway is very famous now for being in the background of various media commitments. But hopefully what won't happen today, because it's not opening hours, that people won't rattle the door and try and come and order a meal. It is what has happened previously, I'm afraid. And also, there were a few comments last time I did one of these and that you could hear a lot of kitchen noises in the background. Unfortunately, there's nobody in the kitchen today. But however, there is a lot of refrigeration equipment that clicks into action.
Well, it's a bit of atmosphere, isn't it? We're
well,
setting the scene.
It's just being polite, really. That's very polite of you to say that. Thank you very much.
And I wonder what noises will be in the background of my second guest's setting. She studied English literature at Trinity College, Dublin, and then completed a master's in creative writing at Queen's University, Belfast. She is awash with academia. She lives on her family farm in County Kildare, which sounds to me, right at this moment, very idyllic. And she's here to tell us about her debut novel, Snowflake. Welcome to Book Off, Louise Neelon.
Thanks a million, Joe. Great to be here.
Ah, it's so lovely to have you both here. And I, as I was writing that intro earlier and I wrote a family farm in County Kildare, obviously I was just swept away with this magical place.
The romanticism.
The romanticism of it. And the fact that I'm currently sat in a city in London. I'm sat in my flat in London dreaming
of... Come do a milking, Joe.
Well, I, you know, I would at this moment.
We're actually we're spreading slurry outside at the minute, so you're lucky that you can't smell where I am now. We're in the family WhatsApp. It was like code brown, close your windows.
when I do come to visit, can it be on a non-slurry day/week?
Well, we can't plan that really. I mean, like, you're just gonna have to look at the draw, Joe. You just get thrown in.
Just see how it goes.
Yeah.
It's great to have you both here. As I've said, we're looking forward to finding out what books you'll be championing a little later on in our Book Off. And Julie, I mentioned it in your intro, but congratulations on the Richard and Judy competition. This is a big deal, isn't it?
It is a big deal. Thank you. Yes, it's completely out of the blue. It's a bit like a fairy tale experience, really. I feel like Prince has knocked at the door eventually and said, "You've won. You've won the prize. The slipper fits you," after various other princes have come along and said that my feet were too big. So it's been...
The book slipper.
Oh, yes, the book slipper. It sounds lovely, doesn't it, like that? Yeah.
Well, and I was just going to say, Louise, at the time of talking, and indeed when this podcast will first go out, your book won't technically be published. It'll be a few weeks away. So how does it feel right now to know that, you know, you are going to be a published author and that it's soon to be in the hands of lots of people that aren't your family and friends?
Yeah, I'm so glad that I'm on with Julie, because I think that she kind of knows the feeling, and I very much feel like I've tried to hack my feet off to try and fit a slipper. And my very bloody feet are now been pampered a bit, and things a bit very, very, very surreal. Yeah, it's very surreal. I feel very lucky, but the dream becoming a reality really is, there's a lot of fear and a lot of excitement. Mm. It's kind of the same emotion.
I was going to say, this is exactly what it's going to be like. I was told off in the early stages for indicating that it was quite so scary, but it is, you know, particularly because we're both country people, really.
Yeah.
I never really understood the word overwhelming before. People used to come up to me and say, it must be terribly overwhelming. And that is what it feels like, in a wonderful way, but also in the slightly scary way as well. And because we're both competition winners, aren't we? So, well, that's how we got started out. So it seems, I think if you'd gone through it in a more conventional way, it might be slightly different. But the competition win makes it feel so lucky and special and wonderful. It just is that tiny bit, extra bit scary as well.
Yeah.
It's definitely a roller coaster of emotions. And I think, having spoken and spent time with a lot of debut authors that have then gone on to, you know, have huge careers, which I've been lucky enough to follow as well, there is a roller coaster of emotions with every book. But I think with the debut, there's just so much more. There's just so much sort of ups and downs with it. But that's great. I think it has to be, because if you were coming to the publishing of your first novel and not really having a strong feeling either way, it would probably mean you're not really into it. So I think
the thing is, I'm one of those people who used to be really jealous of people who won competitions, or jealous of people who got book deals. And I was kind of like, oh, like, screw them. Like, go away with your success. Let me wallow in this. And I was ready. I was ready to put in the hard hours and hard years, and I was ready to struggle. And all of a sudden, everyone's been really nice, and it's happening, and it's kicking off. And I was like, oh, my God. Like, me a year ago would hate me now, you know? I kind of have to come to terms with it and be like, okay, right, get over yourself. It's happening. Make the most of it.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to go with it. You've got to embrace it.
And the other thing is that both of our books have taken about 10 years to get to where they are now. So they've had a long gestation period, and I think they deserve their moment in the spotlight now.
And that, let's talk about them, actually, because that's a good point, Julie, which is also what it feeds into the emotion, because this book has been with you for that amount of time. It's been with us maybe a month, you know, if we bought it in the shops, or we bought it online from a shop. We've sort of read it and enjoyed it, and that's been that. But the whole journey for you has been 10 years, which means that there's so much emotion sort of caught up in it anyway. But let's talk about Happy Family. So the book is about a family who run a Chinese takeaway in West Wales. They say write about what you know. So what was it that made you want to write this story, which is sort of quite similar to your own experiences?
It is similar, but not identical. The reason I wanted to write about it is that I spent, when you start out as a writer, and I think Louise has not made this mistake, that you think, I'm going to go somewhere, and I'm going to go to the city, or I'm going to send my mind around the world and try and find something really, really exciting to write about. And then you realise after a while that there's no place like home. And it's like, Dorothy, the best stories or the good stories are on your doorstep, really. And that's how I came to find this story about this rural location. I mean, it's an exploration of a diverse extended family, including family members who aren't related to you by blood, but perhaps are related to you by love, really. And you wouldn't expect that story. You would expect that story perhaps in Southall or, I don't know, somewhere in Birmingham or Manchester. You might not expect it somewhere in the quiet corner of Wales or Ireland, but here it is. And I thought people didn't know that, so I thought they should see it. So that's how it started out, really. And obviously it is much easier to write something you know a bit about.
Well, of course, and I think it gets asked a lot. It gets asked a lot by me, but debut novelists particularly, or writers of their first book, will just naturally put a bit of themselves in the book, I think. I just think you can't avoid that, really.
I think so too, but when you think about some of the other debut novelists, you do think, are you really a serial killer or something? It's the old basic instinct thing, isn't it, where they go, oh no, Sharon Stone never killed those blokes. She'd never write about it in a book, but now you think, perhaps one of these people is the Sharon Stone character.
But if the serial killer likes a particular brand of whiskey and maybe a particular film or type of music, you know, maybe that's the bit of the author that's in it.
I hope so. I hope that's the part.
Who knows? Want to come back, Julie, and talk about Amy and a little bit more about the story in just a mo. Louise, we've talked about how it feels knowing your first novel will be out soon in the world. So the novel we're talking about is Snowflake. The story of 18-year-old Debbie White, who lives on a dairy farm. So can you set the scene of Debbie's world for us here, and if there are many parallels with your own life here?
Yeah, so obviously, yeah, my fiction is mined from my own experiences, but then it takes on a sort of life of its own. So it's a story about a girl called Debbie, who lives on a dairy farm and goes to college in Dublin, which is very much my experience. Differences between me and Debbie is that we've different families. So Debbie is an only child. She doesn't know who her dad is. And she lives with her mother, who's quite mentally ill and doesn't really feel able to cope with the outside world all that well. She's obsessed with dreams. And she spends a lot of time in her room writing down her dreams and feeling like she has to figure out the cosmos. So Debbie has quite a strange relationship with her, but she really gets on with her uncle, Billy, who lives in a caravan in a field at the back of their house. And Billy's gas and everyone loves him. And he's sort of a really happy alcoholic. You know, like the lad that you find down the pub, you just want to be his best friend. You want him to tell you stories. And he thinks that he can kind of navigate Debbie away from her mother's sort of way of being into a successful kind of free life. And he thinks that that way is through university. So she goes to college in Dublin, and she finds it really alienating. Way that I did. She meets these friends that seem very sophisticated. But she starts to have really strange dreams as well. And so she becomes really sort of disconnected from her sense of self. And then it just becomes a battle between whether Debbie's going to end up liberating herself from her maternal heritage, which is really a history of mental illness in the family, or to break out on her own, or somewhere in the middle.
I think you tackled sort of the modern life, mental illness side of things really, really well, and in a very sort of unique and refreshing way, which I want to talk about in just a mo. Coming back to you, Julie, we've sort of got a bit of the setting and story of your book, but this is a very heartwarming tale, and I, you know, loved reading it. So can you just tell us a little bit more about Amy and the story that she goes through here?
Oh, well, Amy's the granddaughter, so she's the third generation. She's pretty integrated, but she has had that slightly difficult upbringing between the ages of 0 to 18 that Debbie has had. I think something that you would have in common, that if you are the child of immigrant parents or the child of parents who have a mental health condition or other condition that requires you to care for them, that moment when you're 18 and you go, you think, this is great for me, but what about them? So that's the situation that she's been in. But her family is sort of okay and her brother's still around. So she goes away and she has another life for 16 years and then she has to come back. Generally, I mean, a lot of people have had to move home with their mum and dad during the lockdown, and I would not describe the lockdown as being a good thing. So if you have to come back after that time away, it's not a good thing. So she's home. She's living with her grandfather in the flat above the shop. That's where she lived before. She's back where she started. It's not brilliant. Her family is strange. They love each other, but there's some sort of argument or bickering or something that's happened long ago, and her father and her grandfather don't talk to each other. Nobody's willing to sort of discuss it. It's like one of those family secrets. They just sort of mold around it. She wants to get to the bottom of it as a sort of side hobby now that she's back. But the grandfather collapses. So it's like people are taking health a lot more seriously now as well. And you realise that, you know, people fall ill and they can slip away from you very quickly. So she's got a rocket up her ass now, really, to try and sort out what the problem is if she wants to get the family together. But also, she's back in this community, this welcoming Welsh community, and the story's told in two timelines. So there's a timeline in the present with Amy and what's happening, and also the secrets as they bubble up from the 1950s and when her grandfather settled in this part of Wales. That's told in a different timeline. They sort of link up. And I think another part of my life that's reflected in the novel is that I know that when I was small and you'd be like six and your mum would take you to some old lady's house and say, this is Auntie Margaret or this is Auntie Daisy, and you'd look at this like Welsh woman and think, how is she my auntie? But that's the way they were. They would all pile around each other's houses and the front doors would be open and it would all be very welcoming. So I wanted to reflect the welcoming nature, especially when you try and think of rural places as being less diverse or less welcoming to other people.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, with both of these books, family is quite a central issue. And, you know, I've written in my notes, having read both of these books, you know, families love them, but each have their own quirks, don't they? And the most normal, in inverted commas, of families still have their own sort of quirks and traditions and things that they do that's very specific to them. And I suppose, Louise, part of your story and part of the writing of this book is, as you said, you know, there's a bit of your experience in the novel, but the family is very different.
Yeah. And oh, it's so funny. I got off the phone to my uncle who just read it, and he was like, your dad, he got a good deal out of it because he gets to be Billy. And Billy's great, but your poor mother. And there's a scene in the novel with the stairs. I won't go into it. I brought it to a writing workshop, and the guy, Sean O'Reilly, he's an Irish writer, he's a great teacher. And he just said, just like when this goes out, just say you live in a bungalow. Just say you have no stairs in your house. And like that, like so many debut authors, a lot of the interviews and a lot of the feedback you get from people is, oh yeah, it's fiction, but it's you really, isn't it? And I think that the liberation that fiction brings is that, like, yeah, you can use different parts of your family history or different quirks, because there is a lot of, like, say, my uncles and my dad in Billy. Like, there's lines of, say, my uncle got really angry with his daughter for getting drunk on Alka Pops, and he was like, no daughter of mine is getting drunk off Smirnoff Ice. Go to the pub, order yourself a pint of Guinness. So yeah, there's so much like reality in it that I kind of like, there's squirrels of information that I get from everyday life on the farm. The farm is a big part of the book. And I kind of surprised my dad. I wasn't expecting my dad to read it because he doesn't read a lot. But he read it and he was like, geez, like there's a lot of like the landscape. And he didn't realize that I kind of had the same intimacy with the farm as he did, or ownership, not ownership, but like a sense of affiliation with it, but just in a different way. You know, like I'm not the best cow milker in the world. Like they call me the fairy. Like I'm not the one to stand and cover a pit, but or drive a tractor. But yeah, it did bring me closer to my family. But the characters felt like family at the end, really.
Yeah. I wondered if you'd read a book called The Discomfort of Evening.
No.
This is a book that won the Booker International Prize last year, so sort of around this time in 2020. And, well, I don't know, I would sort of, I'd like to recommend it to you, if I may.
Yeah.
Because it's set on a Dutch dairy farm. And it's very different to your book, very different. But I just wonder if you might get something a lot more out of it than a normal. I mean, it's a fabulous book, I have to say.
And
it's by It's by Marieke Lucas Rindveld, I think. I know I had to pronounce that name last year properly, and I've probably butchered it. But they are a debut novelist, very young. They're only 29, and it's just really interesting because they write from the point of view of you know, growing up on a dairy farm, and the book is sort of bonkers and weird and heartfelt and sad, and there's lots going on there, and I think you might really like it. So I just wondered if you'd read it, but if you haven't, it's called The Discomfort of Evening. Before we find out what you've been reading and enjoying recently, I did mention, Louise, that I wanted to talk about the sort of modern life aspect, the mental illness aspect of this book, and I do think you've sort of tackled it in a very refreshing way, and I wondered if there was anything specific that you wanted readers, or you want readers when this book comes out, to take away from the story.
I suppose I wanted to write a story for my 18-year-old self. Mm. When I was 18, I was really struggling, and the mental health services, there was free mental health services in college, which were great, but they could only do so much, and I felt very frustrated by them. Didn't get a lot of answers. I didn't feel like I deserved to be depressed or anxious. And so the only thing that really lifted me out of, I didn't know that I was depressed for ages. I'm on medication now and I'm in therapy, and I've learned a lot of coping skills and life skills. And I think I've matured a lot as a person. But back then, I was just a kid, and it was all darkness. And the thing that really helped me was reading. I read Sunbathing in the Rain by Gwyneth Lewis, who's a poet. And I was like, oh, this is what I'm feeling. And she's coming out of it. And then I just, even books that weren't aimed towards mental illness, I just found them, I always find books to be really medicinal. I don't read for pleasure or entertainment. I do sometimes, but I read for a deeper purpose, just to find friends. friends on the page who, which is kind of like I am reluctant sometimes to recommend books to people, because the things that I might find interesting in it or speak to me may not speak to another person. But yeah, the whole I would like I'm just thinking of myself when I write. I want to write a book that I want to read myself. And I'm quite a selfish reader as well. I don't care what other people are reading. I really don't. And I'm quite possessive sometimes. It's like being at a restaurant and like, I don't care what other people are eating unless it's better than what I have in my plate. And then I'm interested, you know?
I'm the same as you. I literally never look around a restaurant to see what other, because I know
it
ruins it for me. And also, I'm looking at the menu. I know what I want. I want that.
That's it.
And it doesn't matter if over there's got like a sparkler on it, or it comes out on one of those sizzling hot pieces of molten whatever. Don't care.
No. Are you a repeat order? You ordered the same thing at a restaurant?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. Now, that's not to say I don't experiment.
Okay.
Because if I tend to go back to restaurants that I like. So I have my favourites of the menu and indeed the restaurant. It's great. Chinese takeaway in West Wales, actually, that you should check out.
Tell you.
But I
little faces at the window.
Yeah, it's probably me breaking all the rules, driving through about 7 different counties and countries to get there. I sort of know what I like, and if there's a place that I know does it really well, and I know that I'll always enjoy it. But that makes me sound also maybe possibly a little bit dull. Obviously,
I'm dull. I'm happy.
I shake it up from time to time.
People come in and say, well, I'm really boring. I always have the same thing. And I go, you know what you like, so stick with it.
Absolutely.
That's basically it, isn't it? I think this is kind of a judgy thing, isn't it? They think I'm judging them for having the same thing, which I'm not. No. And in the same way, people think, you know, it's the same with everything. Everybody thinks that other people are judging them when really they don't really care what you're doing.
No one cares about
it. And no, of course not. And actually, what's nice about one of the restaurants, which I very much hope is still there, that I used to go to quite often, is I'd walk in, I get a very warm welcome, usually go for a lunch, sit down, and the head waiter there would sort of look at me from across the room and pick up a menu and point at it and go, do you need it? or am I getting you what yours? And some days I'll go, no, I'll have a look. And other days I'll just be like, no. And he'll go off because he knows, you know. And there's something really nice about that, I think. There's something quite comforting.
Yeah.
Not boring, comforting.
Yes, you're a local and they know you well, which is what happens here.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mm. One very final thing, Louise. I just thinking of your 18-year-old self there, and like, I'm so glad to hear that, you know, you have found ways and things that are helping you, because I do think, and this is not really a criticism on anyone or the system or anything, but it's sometimes when with people's approach to mental health, it's a bit paint by numbers. And I do think that you can't just say this works, you know, because for some people it doesn't. And there's it's important for everyone to sort of find their thing and their way of improving.
Like a Chinese restaurant, you need to have a menu of options, you know?
See?
Very good.
But I just think the creativity needs to be part of even if a person goes to their local doctor. Hmm. That the doctor doesn't straight away have to put them on medication or have to recommend CBT. I got CBT recommended to me so many times
It works for some people and it doesn't, and for others, they, you know, it just doesn't connect.
And I remember paying a horrific amount, half an iPhone, to go see this psychotherapist who I was 8 years in the system now, nothing was working, and he was like, it was a woman, actually. She was like, I recommend CBT. And I was like, CBT hasn't worked for me. And she was like, okay, we just won't call it that then. I was just like, you can't do that to a person who's really struggling, you know, and in pain. Like, it just needs a lot more options for people to discover like who they really are. And I actually really enjoy therapy now, and I enjoy trying to live a better life. I mean, you realize that you have all the tools in yourself, not going to a therapist and they sort it out. And I realized I'm really lucky as well. Funding is a whole different conversation, and I just, yeah, it breaks my heart. And going into schools now and talking to kids is something that I really like doing.
Oh, good for you. Well, I'm glad to hear you're doing that as well. I'm sure that they find it very helpful to hear from you. Go on, Julie.
I was going to say, the thing about Snowflake is that you said you wrote it because it was the sort of book you want to read. And in a way, it's about being seen. I feel as you go to a therapist, she probably says, is it about being seen, Louise? Having, for people to know that that sort of thing exists. I think it's important that we see that people are 18 and they have mental health problems. If you have that problem, you're not the only one. Yeah. There are loads of other people. If you don't see it in a book or see it on television or in a film, you think, I'm a freak. I'm the only one. And that's so not true. And that's what your book does. And your talks in school.
And it's and I think that, you know, it is changing. If you think back to, you know, when we were growing up, when we were children, you know, it just the whole sort of mental health awareness thing just wasn't part of a conversation. And now it has changed, and for the better. In the fact that we're sitting here on a podcast sort of openly talking about it is great, I think. And you're so right, Julie, you know, for it to be in books, to be in our television screens and in our stories just makes it just so much more normalized, in the sense that, like, anyone going through it knows they're not alone. And I think that's one of the absolute key things. So it's really interesting, Louise, you don't always read for pleasure. And I think that's a really great statement. What about you, Julie? What have you been reading recently and enjoyed? And do you read for pleasure, or is there a little bit of...
I'm afraid I only read for pleasure, unfortunately. I think at the start of the year, I decided, though, that I would read one book from the literary canon and then one book that I would enjoy, and that hasn't worked out so well, because it's we're well into the year now. The only book from the canon that I have read is The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, which I've not read any other Le Carre.
Julie, I just read that recently.
It's interestingly dated, isn't it?
I didn't like it.
Didn't you like it?
I don't know what everyone's wanging on about. Well, 6 out of 10. I mean, it is dated. God, sorry, I've sort of jumped in on
you. No, you go ahead, because nobody else has read it that I can discuss it with, so off you go.
It's dated, but also I don't know why it's held up as some sort of literary masterpiece or whatever. Like, you know, a modern classic as it is. I didn't get it. It left me feeling cold, a bit like The Spy.
Yeah, I suppose perhaps everything that it explored 50 years ago has become a cliché, so perhaps that may be a part of the problem. But it's certainly interesting to look at as an antique piece. But, you know, he's very good. That ambiguity about two-thirds of the way through between the different sorts of agent that he comes across. I found that I had to sort of, like, read it and then put it down and think, I'll have to think about this for a bit, and then go back and read a bit more. But I do see what you mean about perhaps not liking it. There were a few moments when I was reading it and I was thinking, this could go either way. But on the whole, I think it was beneficial to read it.
It's very interesting, though, that you said about the clichés, because on another episode of Book Off in this series, we had the author Emily M. Danforth on. And she, one of her Book Off pitch was actually The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. And she said when she was reading it that she... she said that before she read it, she thought, oh, it sounds a bit cliche, like all the cliches of a horror novel, blah, blah, blah. And then she realised when she did finally read it that they were cliches because she'd invented them.
She'd invented the cliches.
And I wonder if maybe I'm having a bit of, maybe John le Carré invented all this stuff, like you say, and I'm just thinking, God, but actually he was the first. So maybe that's different. I don't know. It was weird. I just didn't connect with that book. But there we go.
Anyway, yes, I see where you're coming from. in terms of the books for myself or the fun books, let's see. Well, one of them is the book I've chosen for the book off, so I won't say anything about that right now. I've noticed that, you know, books come in crazes, and every now and again you have all these books about girls doing various things and various vampires doing various things. And there seem to be two crazes at the moment. One is psychological thrillers set in a snowy landscape. That's very popular right now. I haven't read any of those yet. And the other one is romances revolving around a dog.
It's a bit more niche, that one, isn't it?
One of them is called The Dog Sitter, I think, which I haven't read. And the other one is called Rescue Me, which I think is by somebody called Sarah Manning. But anyway, I've read Rescue Me, and it's like a fun book. I don't know if I should disclose this, but it's a good job that ladies go to the toilet sitting down, because you can squeeze in a bit of reading then, which obviously gentlemen can't do. So that's been my companion during those times. So you can read like a few pages, two or three times a day.
Just, you know, and that's, I was going to say, that's about 10 pages a day you're getting through there.
Yes, so I've managed to read that book on my phone there. So, yeah, yes, dogs are going to be a big thing. Get a dog in your next
Get a dog, please. Get a dog, and write about it. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. What have you read recently, Louise, that you've enjoyed that you might like to recommend?
So I've read Lucky Enough to Get a Proof of Boys Don't Cry by Fiona Scarlett.
It's amazing.
Yeah, love it. It's out with Faber in April, I think. It's about two young boys. And it reminds me, it's Bang of Roddy Doyle off it, and also Louise O'Neill.
Yes,
I think,
yeah.
Two very blended, but she's, yeah, a stunning debut. Reading Maeve McGuckian poetry, she is a poet from Northern Ireland. Seamus Heaney described her as her language as the inner lining of consciousness, which is just. There's a documentary on her on BBC at the minute, and it is fab, 20 minutes. It's about how she entered the National Poetry Competition under a pseudonym, because she knew she wouldn't win with an Irish name. and she won.
That's amazing.
She's very underwritten about, and not heralded as much as she should be. A lot of Snowflake, the ideas that I got around Chills and Dreams came from Maeve McGuckin's poetry, so love her. Also, Patrick Frayne, Okay, Let's Do Your Stupid Idea. It's non-fiction, kind of David Sedaris. He's a journalist over in Ireland here. And he does class columns, I think for the Irish Times. And this is his first book. I wasn't expecting it to be as sad as it was. He had a lot of grief of losing friends and stuff.
Mm.
But it is stunning. You laugh and cry in the same story. And it's very, very easy to read as well. So that's what I'm reading at the minute.
What's that one called again?
Okay, Let's Do Your Stupid Idea.
Fantastic. Oh, what a great set of recommendations, and a very broad set, I would say, there from both of you. So thank you for those.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's time now for the book off, and this is where each of you is going to get 3 minutes to tell us about a book that you love, that you think me and the listeners should all read. And I can tell you, listeners, because we're on camera here, that there are some scared-looking faces staring back at me right now. Now, here's a few little ground rules that you need to know, Louise and Julie. You don't have to use all 3 minutes. It's okay if you don't, but if you're still talking as the timer hits the 3 minute mark, I will either be honking you out or ringing you out with a school bell, okay? And that you will be cut off at your 3 minutes. So it's up to you whether you want to go to the whistle, as it were, or go to the horn, or if you want to try and bring it in beforehand. Before we find out the books, let's decide who goes first and who goes second. Julie, would you like to go first or second?
I am going to let Louise decide.
Oh, Julie, switching it up.
Oh, look at this. All right. Go on then, Louise.
I will go. I really want to hear Julie's, and I know if I go second, I won't hear hers, because I'll just be thinking about mine, so I'll go first.
You're going first. All right, Julie. You're not getting away without making a decision, though.
I want the bell.
You want the bell? Okay, right.
She already
knows. She already knows. Okay, fine. In which case, Louise, that means you're getting the bicycle horn. So before we start the timer, just tell us the book that you're putting forward.
I'm putting forward A Goat Song by Dermot Healy.
Fantastic. All right. Well, it's over to you. 3 minutes on the clock to tell us about A Goat Song.
Okay. So A Goat Song by Dermot Healy is a book set in the west of Ireland. And it's a story of a man called Jack Ferris. He's a playwright and a fisherman. And he's waiting for the love of his life, Catherine Adams, to come home to him. At least that's what he thinks he's waiting for, as he drifts in and out of an alcoholic haze, really. So on Christmas Eve, he signs himself in to hospital for treatment. And he finds there that as he's transcribing other patients' stories of suffering, he finds a sense of liberation from his own loneliness. So he decides to tell the story of Catherine in order to try and release himself from the pain of her absence. So A Goat Song is a modern day tragedy. Tragedy actually comes from the words goat song, which Jack explains to Catherine in their first meeting, which I'll read a bit now. What do you do anyway? She asked. I do a spot of writing. This made her pause. Writing, she said disbelievingly. What sort of writing? Plays. I'm interested in plays. What kind? I pen songs of the book, Billy tunes. I'm sorry? Goat songs. Is that so? That'd be the height of it. Catherine looked at him. That's all very interesting, but I don't know what you're talking about. Tragedies. Tragos. Goat. OD. Song. From the Greek. I never knew that. There you go. Every time you weep in the theatre, you're listening to a goat singing. You're joking. Not at all. In the early days, the Greek goat herds used to put the books on one island and the nannies on the other. When the nannies were in heat, their smell would come on the breeze to the books who rose a mournful cry. The poor things. That's what I thought. And why didn't they just jump in the water and swim across to them if they were so frustrated? Ah, but that's the crux of the matter, Jack Ferris said. You see, goats can't swim. So before I read A Goat Song, I used to be ashamed of my own loneliness. And when I opened this book, it was like Dermot Healy flung a door open and threw his arms around me and welcomed me in by a warm fire and told me all about his pain and suffering. And I learned from him that loneliness could be transformative, and that actually revealing your own vulnerabilities, your own sense of failure, can be the most important gift that you can give to somebody. So that's why I think a goat song should be read. It should be not only read by everyone, I think it should be championed as a classic. And I just want to thank Dermot Healy. He's passed away in 2014, but he was a really important writer to me. It's a really important book to me. Thanks.
Oh, wonderful. What a lovely end to that pitch. Oh, yes, yes, quite right, Julie. A little ripple of applause there. Good sportsmanship. Wonderful. I love that. And I don't know the book, so it's you know, when it's always fun hearing a pitch about a book I know, because there's always something revealing within it. And it's also lovely when I just don't know anything about it at all, and that was the case. Have a rest now, Louise. We'll come back and talk about that shortly. And now you can, sit back and listen properly. Before we put the 3 minutes back on the clock, Julie, which book are you putting forward for us?
It's a book called The Snow and the Works on the Northern Line by Ruth Thomas.
Fantastic.
It's only come out just recently.
I'm going to put your 3 minutes on, so if you're ready, it's over to you.
Right. From Jane Eyre to Eleanor Oliphant, via Bridget Jones and Esther Greenwood, The Snow and the Works on the Northern Line is another of those novels told by a quirky first-person female voice. And honestly, who would have thought we need any more of those? Sybil Wiseman is 26. Notice that name, because names are important in this book. She's just started a new job at the Royal Institute of Prehistoric Studies in South London, known by the rather fabulous acronym of RIPS. While visiting Streatham Ice Rink with her boyfriend Simon, Sybil bumps into her former university lecturer. Well, she doesn't literally bump into her, but the shock of seeing such an unpleasant blast from her past causes her to skid across the ice, and it's her head that takes the bump as she hurtles across the ice into the barriers. That was the lecturer who used to pick on Sybil in tutorials and try to mark her down in her finals. She's now moved out of academia and into managing museums in the South London area, including RIPS. Excuse me. She is Sybil's ultimate line manager, and her name is Helen Hansen. So remember what I said about names. Well, like that other Helen, this Helen can take her pick of any man she chooses, and she chooses Sybil's boyfriend. Sybil's home life and her work life are ruined. Where is there to be a refuge from all this turmoil? Sybil's colleague Jane Beecham suggests poetry classes to take her mind off it all. Jane Beecham, it's a fantastic English name because it's pronounced Beecham, but it's spelt Beauchamp, like French for beautiful fields. And if someone called Beautiful Fields gives you advice, you take it. So, it's an evening class in poetry at Brixton Library for Sybil. Now, we didn't discuss this, but I'm not very keen on poetry. I only like it if it rhymes or if it's really short. So luckily, Sybil writes haikus. So that's just 17 syllables long. And this is one of them. Office morning. Where are the paper clips? Also, where is the hole punch? So it's like a little Adrian Mole poem there. I love Adrian Mole. He's one of my top five poets of all time. But there is proper poetry in here as well, including one called A Poison Tree by William Blake, which is well worth looking up, but I'd never heard of before. And it's really good. You know it's good because it rhymes. Right, here's another one from Sybil. Tottenham Court Road contains 5 syllables. Stockwell contains 2. As you can see, the book is set firmly in London, which, given what we've both discussed about Chinese takeaways in Wales and farms in Ireland, I didn't think it would be for me. I'm rushing now because I think I'm running out of time. But instead of a story about a glamorous city hogging the limelight and looking down on its country cousins, it's a touching, funny, no! No, my haiku! Lovely Joe Haddo, please do pick my book in the book off. Go on! It's my haiku!
Oh, well, I will. Look, if someone's writing a haiku about me, then you get a few extra seconds. Don't you worry, Julie. That's fair enough. Oh, brilliant. Well done. Take a little breather now as well.
Thank you.
Another book I don't know. You said it's new. It's just come out.
It just came out at the start of this year.
Yeah, fantastic. To go back to A Goat Song, if I may, Louise, I found that there was almost, you know, the sort of everything in that pitch that's possibly in the book, because you went from sort of talking about this alcoholic's haze, the fact that he's a playwright, that he finds a sense of liberation from his own sort of loneliness and sadness. And then you went on to say how much it meant to you as a book, how it welcomed you in, I think is what you said. And, you know, that revealing your own vulnerability is something that we should really, you know, be looking at. And I just think, what a wonderful thing that a book's been able to give you. And it also makes me think of, like, I hate to bring it back to Chinatown again, but, like, I will go very happily to said restaurant where the waiter points at the menu and sit there by myself, reading, not reading, watching, you know. That's not loneliness, I know, but there is still a sort of strange stigma in someone on their own, doing something on their own, I think. And yet I love it.
Yeah.
There's, you know, I actually quite like being alone some of the time, you know.
One of my favourite things to do is to be alone in a city. So one of my favourite things is just to wander around Dublin, wander in and out of the galleries. Like, you're surrounded by people and you can people watch, but you actually don't have to talk to anybody, which is great.
You also do everything on your own agenda.
Yeah. I loved going travelling on my own. I went to Edinburgh on my own there. It was bliss, absolute bliss.
And I think, so I don't know if that's quite what you were saying about this book, but I think there, you know, that not being ashamed of your own loneliness, and by that I mean, you know, on a deeper level than just, oh, I could go walk around a city on my own, but actually it's okay,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, just to sit with your own, like, all of your messiness, you know? And I think, like, we absolutely, to quote Walt Whitman, we contain multitudes. And I remember my friend saying that, like, she couldn't imagine having a boyfriend or a partner because there's so many people inside her already. And I really felt that as a writer, that I'm quite happy to be alone and to knock the crack out of myself, you know?
Yeah.
Have fun. But also sit with the sadness when it does pop up, and there is a stigma around you should have friends. And that's when I went to college, I found myself being alone a lot, having to go for lunch on my own. And I hated people seeing me eat alone, because I came from school and the social hierarchy of school, like, where you ate lunch, who you ate lunch with, that was your group. Whereas, like, with university, you're just, like, completely stripped of all of that social buffering or cushioning that you had in school. And it's taken me years to grow into just being happy out.
Well, wonderful pitch, and a book I definitely want to read now, thanks to you. And on the very different end of the scale in some ways, Julie, this sounds...
I think the three of us sound like confident loners. But I know you said sad old loners then. And again, the book, you know, this book is about loneliness as well, which obviously I didn't get to that point in the pitch. But yes, and she's lonely in the city as well. It's just the circumstances that make you lonely rather than alone. No, she's definitely lonely. But, you know, I'm surprised and really pleased that both of you said that you go out to places on your own and do things, because that's what I do. And there is a stigma around it. People do look at you funny, but tough.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I'm one of those people who goes, let them look. The more they look, the more I want to, the more I would like, if I had a book with me, I'd put it down and stare right back at them. Just be like, here I am. But it sounds very funny. Your pitch was very funny, Julie, anyway. And I loved the beginning where you sort of said, do we really need another quirky female voice? It turns out we might do, actually. Jane Eyre, Eleanor Oliphant, Bridget Jones, tick, tick, tick. Sybil sounds fab. I love the importance of names in it. And your sort of honesty around poetry as well. Fair enough, it isn't for everyone. But who doesn't love Adrian Mole? And who doesn't love a haiku, especially when it's about themselves? So thank you for that. Thank you for my own haiku. It sounds great, that book. It sounds like it's well worth a
definitely gonna order it.
Oh, thank you. And I will look at the Goat Song as well. But the both of them, because people say, why isn't something really, really exciting happen about two thirds of the way of your book? And I'm like, doesn't always happen, mate.
It's true.
So yes, I would say that's possibly the situation with this book too. But some stories are quieter.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the Snow and the Works on the Northern Line. That's by Ruth Thomas, and A Goat Song by Dermot Healy. Now, you know the game. Two fabulous pictures, but I've got to pick one to go home with, as it were, for all the listeners, on behalf of the listeners. And I'm sure many are listening, thinking, God, he's not picking on behalf of me because he's chosen ones in the past. Which blah, blah, blah. But based on the pitch, I'm going to go for A Goat Song.
I was robbed.
Now, listen, I don't want to take anything away from the haiku, Julie, because I really, really, really enjoyed it. I think the reason I've gone for A Goat Song is because the very end, I think because of what an impact it's had on you personally, Louise, and your writing, I think that's why. And that's what just took it at the end, okay?
Emotional blackmail.
Basically, yes.
Every time.
Basically, telling me that, you know, the author passed away and that you to you. Yeah, really, yeah. It worked.
He was a great guy.
Fabulous book off, though. Well done to both of you. And Happy Families by Julie Marr is out now. It's published by Welbeck. And Snowflake by Louise Neelan is coming out in May from Manila Press. Or if you're listening to this after the 13th of May, it's out now. Julie, Louise, what an absolute pleasure to spend an hour with you. Thank you so much for your company and thank you for your book recommendation.
Thank you.
Thanks a million.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.